right. We'll get the Judiciary Committee up and running. It's 1:35. We have Senator Olson, Senator Dyson with us, Senator McGuire, Chairman Coghill. The two things that we are going to do today is take up House Bill 47. I understand the House is on the floor at this point, so we'll have staff for Representative Feige. And then House Bill 284 was going to be introduced to us by Representative Keller. I told him probably by 2 o'clock. So if we do any action on House Bill 47, if it's before 2 o'clock, we will take it at ease. If it's still going at 2 o'clock, we're going to hold it over until Representative Keller gets to have his say. Anyway, that's my intention. Linda Hay is here with Representative Feige's office on House Bill 47. Linda, why don't you come on up to the committee? I know there was a couple of questions that came up last time, and I think it was the Department of Environmental Conservation that was going to give some testimony. We had a very, very bad, connection, and it was with Lynn Kent, I think. At least that's who's online right now. That's not the name I remember.
Linda Hay, Staff to Rep Feige. We have two people online, as far as I know, for DEC.
Lynn Kent,
Deputy Commissioner, and Ruth Hamilton Hesse from Department of Law.
Ruth Hamilton Hesse, that's the one that
we lost last time.
Ruth, are you online? Can you hear us okay?
Yes, Chairman, I can hear you just fine. Thank you.
That is a whole lot better than what we had last week. And so I ended up not being able to communicate very well with you. Was there any other points that you needed to bring up under House Bill 47 at this point?
Senator, I think that we have explained previously, and I'm more than happy to put it on the record again, the reason for the exemptions for the primacy programs, if you'd like.
If you wouldn't mind, I think it's going to be, with this connection, a lot more clear to the committee. And I have one member who is not here now is here.
Very well, and thank you. And I apologize for the technical difficulties we had the last time. So the state agencies were concerned for the primacy programs, and in this case, they're primacy programs that were approved by EPA or the Department of Interior for Clean Water Act regulation, Clean Air regulation, as well as the coal program that the state administers under more largely the SMCRA, Federal Surface Mining Control Act. We were concerned that the injunction provisions anticipated for HB 47 may be viewed by the federal agencies as chilling third parties' access to the courts if those third parties, and mainly in this case we're talking about non-governmental organizations or individuals, might be deterred from challenging a primacy permit that the state issues. And so therefore, we had worked with a sponsor to exempt the state primacy programs from the bill's application because we didn't want to see the federal agencies withdraw their approvals of our programs. And again, typically injunctions accounting for lost wages, for example, aren't usually entered in the federal courts for federally administered programs, and this was just to avoid having the federal agencies look at our programs as being less accessible for judicial challenges. The proposed revisions in HB 47 that have been set out in subsection D, do take care of our concerns. And with that, I'll take any further questions you may have.
Just for the committee's benefit, we have Nancy Mead from the courts here for questions, John Hutchins from Department of Law, Ruth Hamilton Hesse, who's just now speaking to us, and Lynn Kent with DEC. Ruth, probably for you, does this prevent, maybe that's not the best way of saying it, for somebody who wants, as an individual, to put forward a public interest litigation, Under these provisions, there would have to be a bond potential. What would be the process that the court would have to go, or the law would go through to say, how would we apportion that under this condition for somebody who wanted to be a public interest litigant?
Are you speaking to the bill more broadly or to the exemption provision?
More broadly, because I think last time we were met, one of the questions came up that this would stop individual people who are just kind of like me, poor boy, from stepping up to do a public interest litigation.
I will refer to John Hutchins on that question because
right.
He is the lead AAG on that.
John, are you available online?
Yes, I am.
You got the question?
I did hear the question.
Thank you.
I believe the process would be identical to the current process under Rule 65.
And so we're requiring bonding. I understand that. How do they think about apportioning it under a condition where, for example, a third party who is largely backed by somebody compared to somebody who has a neighborhood problem?
Well, a hearing will be held to determine whether a preliminary injunction should issue. And at that hearing, both parties would be represented, and the judge would determine first whether there is irreparable injury, and if there is an irreparable injury, the party seeking the injunction would have to make a showing that he raises non-frivolous questions of law. If there is no showing that there would be an irreparable injury, actually, if there is no showing that there would be an irreparable injury or the injury to the party against whom the injunction would issue would not be adequately compensated by a bond, there would also have to be a showing that there's a likelihood of success on the merits. Once the judge determines that the actual injunction should issue, the judge would consider the factors that the judge ordinarily considers under Rule 65, and under this legislation would also consider the amount of wages and benefits for employees or payment to contractors and subcontractors that may be suffered, and determine what the amount of the bond should be and then set the appropriate bond.
Okay. Just for the committee's edification, we've been joined by Senator Wilkowski. So I'm going to put this in plain language that I understand and see if I'm getting it right. If somebody can show that there's significant and credible damage, they can make their day in court, and then the judge would then at that point consider how to evaluate, how to put value on that. If there's real damage, like you're saying, then this bonding could kind of suit the circumstances of the person who felt that they were going to be damaged significantly.
Yes, that's mostly right. I would say more than significant injury. It has to be some sort of injury that can't be compensated by a monetary award if the party prevails. It would have to be some sort of injury that is irreparable.
Okay. I know I did. Is there any other questions at this point? I did have one person who wanted to testify, and all these others are here for question. And Senator Wilkowski, we have Nancy Mead from the court here. We have John Hutchison, who just talked with us, Ruth Hamilton Hussey, who is on a much better connection line this today, and then Lynn Kent. But I'd like to open up the testimony for Barbara Huff-Tuckness to come up, and she asked if we could do this. She was not available last time, and I did not close public testimony. So, Barbara.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you again for allowing me to testify on CS for House Bill 47. I will make my comments very brief, but I did want to go on record on behalf of for the record, my name is Barbara Huff-Tuckness, Director of Legislative and Governmental Affairs for Teamsters Local 959. We would like to go on record in support of this particular legislation. There have been allegations that, well, this does nothing but stop the permitting process. And we've worked with the sponsor's office, talked with many individuals. We have personally had some of our own members. Now, this was on a federal project, not on a state project, who actually was laid off the job after the contractor went through the permitting process. They dotted all their I's, crossed their T's, made sure that theoretically everything was done. And then there was an injunction that was filed. And we had, I mean, total, and it wasn't just Teamsters, there were many other workers that were laid off the project for approximately 2, 3, 4 weeks, totaling a couple hundred. It was not under the state law. It was actually under the federal. And we've actually tried researching some examples under the state law. And everything that we've come across where there has at least been an issue raised, they've never gone anywhere. And there's been a resolution of some sort. And we've never had to go through this type of process. But our concern is if indeed the contractor has been awarded a job, they actually walk through all of the permitting processes as required. They've done everything right on the job site. And then once they start the actual project itself, there's a wrongful, or it's determined to be a wrongful enjoyment, then at least from our perspective, we believe that there needs to be a little bit of skin in the game, for lack of a better word. There are workers that are impacted by this as well. And while we support protecting our environment and making sure that everything that is actually when there is construction done, that it's done in an environmentally safe way. Once you've walked through all of those steps, then we think that it is fair to allow for that construction to move forward without undue interference. And for that reason, we want to go on record supporting the bill.
Thank you for coming to the committee. Is there questions at this point? Thank you, Barbara. Greatly appreciate it. I don't have any other public testimony at this point. If I could just get the representative to the representative here. You've heard some of the conversation in committee. Is there anything that we have missed from your perspective on the testimony that's come both through the Department of Law and other testimony questions?
For the record, Linda Hay, Staff Rep Feige. No, I don't think I have much of anything else to add.
All right. Senator. Are there any questions for the representative or the representative? I think it comes down to a kind of a comfort level of making sure that people have some input in the permitting processes and that there is a last resort, but that last resort, if there's irreparable harm done, then they actually have a good case to make. Otherwise, there's a bond that is required, the way I understand it. Any discussion in the committee? I'd entertain a motion.
I'll move it. Okay, I move CS for House Bill number 47. We didn't amend it.
We did not amend it, no.
Individual Why? Recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think we need to do this. I think, you know, I'm concerned about the people who own property, whose property is being threatened by some sort of action, and are just not are going to be financially foreclosed from exercising their constitutional rights to go to the courts. There's a law in the books already requiring security. I think this is probably going to increase the amounts, which are closing the doors to the courts, to the middle class, to working families, and I can't support that, Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm also objecting because I see that at least the rural population that I represent, we are at a disadvantage because you don't have the security there, you don't have the collateral. Many of the meager items that they own are certainly not going to qualify, and this puts another hurdle in the way and makes it prohibitive for them to go ahead and try and object to development out in the rural areas that I certainly represent and am from. And because of that, I cannot support this legislation.
Any other comments? Well, I'm going to support it. In the testimony that we heard from the Department of Law, that the judge gets to take these circumstances into consideration. So if it's a third party, it would be appropriate. If it's an individual, the judge would be able to apportion appropriately. So I think that this is well within the ability of a judge to give the proper discretion to the needs. So any other comment at this point? I will call the roll.
Senator McGuire.
Yes.
Senator Dyson.
Yes.
Senator Olson.
No.
Senator Willikowski.
No.
Chair Coghill.
Yes.
Three yeas, two nays.
So with three yeas and two nays, we'll pass the bill out of committee to the next committee referral, and we'll see where it goes from there. Thank you very much. Take a brief at ease while we sign this off. All right. It's 5 minutes to two. We're back online. We just about gaveled out, and then the representative came running into the room. And I guess the House is still in session, but you're excused. And now we'll bring up House Bill 284, which is before us. This is an interstate compact on a balanced federal budget. Several of these questions have been coming around, including compact of states, and this is a little different. This is a interstate compact. So we have with us Representative Keller, who is the sponsor of the bill, and he wanted to take us through a sectional approach to it, and he has a PowerPoint presentation, way I understand it. So Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really appreciate you hearing this bill. And we all know, nobody would argue that we've got a problem with the national debt. We're all aware of it, and it is a painful and exploding thing that's out there. HB 284 just uses Article 5, the U.S. Constitution, to address that problem by putting a restriction balanced budget amendment on the in the U.S. Constitution. I'm trying to figure out how to move this forward here.
The right arrow.
Okay.
Could you give him a hand there, Jordan? There you go.
There we go. I got it. That's just a graphic of the debt. You can see it's not a partisan issue. Clinton, Bush, Obama, but that red slope is getting steeper all the time. And I've met a few people that say, that we exaggerate the problem, or, some people tend to exaggerate the problem, but everybody knows it has to be dealt with. And HB 284 tries that. The tool we try to use is Article 5. That's Article 5 right there in its entirety in the U.S. Constitution. We'll talk a little bit more about it. There's a graphic that I use just to help me understand. The Article 5 itself proposes two ways to get the proposed amendment in place, and also several members, ways of ratification. And the main way to get to that amendment convention is to get two-thirds of the states to agree to make application to Congress to go ahead and let them, or to put a, to have this convention, this amendment convention, to propose amendments that then are put forward for ratification. I put this slide up mostly because over on the left-hand side, you can see the different groups there that are work, you know, various ones that are working on. You already mentioned Convention of the States.
Yeah.
They're all the efforts are trying to get to the two-thirds trigger so we can apply for amendment convention. HB 284 varies in one thing, and that is that it has built in the call to Congress for the amendment. It has included the amendment, and it has, you know, made a series of laws that bring us all the way directly to the three-fourths of the states at which time we get to the ratification. One thing, just wanted to put a point out here, this Reagan project, you see it up there, the second from the bottom, that's Fritz Pettyjohn is working on that, and I believe Robin Taylor is working on it, and the citizens of the Convention of the States, I've been personally impressed and helpful to all those. The point that I'm trying to make mostly is that there's not a competition here. It's not an either-or. It doesn't hurt. They build on each other. They're compatible. And I wholeheartedly endorse the Convention of the State that you've already dealt with. But this is just a different approach. You might say belts and suspenders. That's the entirety of the slide that I have. And what I'm going to do is, like your chair said, is I'm going to go over the entire bill with a sectional here. But please understand that I am not pretending to be a compact expert or a constitutional lawyer or anything like that. But the HB 284 is not my idea. There's a lot of good experts and people that have put this together, and they're online. I have Nick Drenius from the Goldwater Institute. I'm pretty sure he's called in, and he's there to answer questions, and he's carried this from the very beginning. But also the Cato Institute senior fellow in constitutional studies, Ilya Shapiro, has been involved. American Academy for Constitutional Education. There's also a senior judge, Harold DeMoss, of the U.S. Court of Appeals, Fifth Circuit, who has put forward, like, the Q&A that's online under this bill. They've all looked at it, endorsed it, gone through it. And so it's not, I'm not putting this forward as this is something Keller dreamt up. There's good people behind it. And we got the, I'm enthused. I'm an advocate, but. So for a lifeline, I have Nick online, and if you...
Well, before we get there, has anybody on the committee not worked on a compact with other states at this point? I think we have passed through at least six or seven that I am aware of where we compact, and that's actually a constitutional provision that allows states to compact under certain issues. The last one I worked with was under child need of aid agreements, I think. We've worked on military compacts with high school graduation issues. So there's a whole range of compacts. So I don't think there's anybody on the committee that's not familiar with it. Okay, that's good.
Super.
Did you want to have some testimony at this point? Or do you want to walk through
Mr. Chair, I'm going to, you know, it's your time, your call. Let me go through the overview of the sectional. I'll do that as quickly as I can, and that'll just give you an overall vision of the bill, and then we can go from there.
Let's do it that way.
Okay, in Article 1, Section 1, is just the policy, the purpose, and the intent of the compact. And if you go down to Article 2, it starts on page 2, line 8 of the bill. It goes all the way through page 3, line 6. You've got a whole series of definitions that are used in the bill. Also in Article 2, Section 7, page 3, line 7 to page 4, line 27, that's where the actual balanced budget amendment is. So that's page 3, line 7 through page 4, line 27. And what the balanced budget is in a sentence or two is it just says, hey, federal government, input has to equal output. The cap on the debt is 105% unless the states authorize by a simple majority, a raising of that cap. It also has a section in there that says that Congress may not add a new tax or revenue without a two-thirds vote of Congress, or if the tax is a flat tax or a sales tax, in other words, a reformed types tax. Then if you go down to Article 3, that's the actually talks about the compact membership and withdrawal. That starts on page 4, line 28, goes through page 6, line 10. And that just talks about the compact, how it's a contract between each state. So you're familiar with that, so it doesn't, I won't dwell on that. You go to Article 4, is the where it defines the commission that is established by the compact and the compact administrator. It all outlines the powers and the duties. The thing to it's important to remember on this one is that it's mostly the powers and duties are restrictions and limitations of power. It's not an expansion of power, because this process and this approach, I'm sure you've heard through the Convention of the States discussion that there are some concerns of a runaway convention. This particular approach has gone just extreme to the extreme, where the it's very highly unlikely that it could ever become a runaway. And so when you get into the compact commission and compact administrator definitions, you'll see that it's very tight to keep everything on track. So it's all targeted at this balanced budget amendment. Article 5 is actually the application, the word application. If you look in Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution, this is the bill that actually puts that in place. The states make application. And it also says in there how it requires three-quarters of the states to be in place before there can be a the compact could take effect. The ratification process is dependent. We'll get to that in a little bit, but it's dependent on Congress calling the time in for the convention, ultimately the ratification convention. Article 6, that talks about our delegate appointment limitations and instructions. That's on page 9, line 19 through page 11, line 19. And the delegate, there's one vote for each state, and the delegate is the governor of each state. It outlines how a state's delegate may be recalled if there's a huge unforeseeable problem. There's a provisions for an oath that the governor takes, and basically it's a 24-hour convention at the point that there's three-fourths of the states are there and it's over. And his calling is to go down and vote yay or nay on this balanced budget amendment. That's probably a little fast and a little bit, well, simplistic, but that's if you read it, you'll see that's the essence of it. Also in Article 6, you've got the term limits for the delegates, and it basically is for the term of the compact. And the term of the compact, incidentally, is there's a seven-year sunset on this. It gives us 7 years to get the job done. The power and authority of the convention delegates are described in this section. It talks about the first order of business for the convention will be the adoption of the rules. That's in the next section. And if the convention is one of the safeguards, there's been 16 or 20 of them, but one of the safeguards is that when they come down there, if they have refused to or failed to adopt the rules that are set forth in HB 284, it's all over. That's the end of their action. It talks then in Article 7, it actually sets up the convention rules, and you can look through those. Again, it's the sole agenda is for the balanced budget amendment. It talks about the number of delegates that can be there. There's only one delegate who's a voting member from each state, but there's maybe different combinations of people that go down there with the governor. It talks about the quorum. It talks about relocating, if that be the necessity, to follow what rules to follow. Then Article 8 is really an important one. If you want to look at that, it's on page 13, line 30, through page 14, line 16. Basically, it says member states are prohibited from participating in the convention unless first Congress passes the omnibus resolution calling for the convention. And that's why, very specifically, this is very unlikely to be called unconstitutional, because it puts that right up front. We have to work with Congress. Congress has to respond to this before it could happen.
My guess is that's probably the similarity between this and the Convention of the States, is that it requires Congress to act.
Yes. Right. Yes, it does. At some point, that's part of the Article 5. So it also, in Section 2 in Article 8, it's really important that any proposal that's outside of the scope of the balanced budget amendment, it says that whatever proposal or action is done is void. And then Article 9 is about the prospectively ratifying the Constitution, how that happens. Article 10 is a construction enforcement venue and severability, and that's an interesting section article, because it basically says that there are certain sections of this compact that cannot be eliminated. You know, you might imagine if you go in there and eliminate the part that reduces the restrictions on you, you know, then, of course, you could do anything you want. So the severability does not allow, separation of Article 8. But it also sets it up so that if the compact section or element of this process is somehow thrown out of court, the law would still stand as a parallel law with other states. And that's where it fits with Convention of the States, because if, say, 10 states, had this passed, and then there happened to also be another effort to get the Convention of States together and they got the two-thirds, then it's possible that this parallel legislation could be used in that context. So there is overlap, and it's a good belts and suspenders kind of situation. With that, Mr. Chair, there's another couple things that jumped on my mind that I went over probably too quickly. But one is, there was a concern raised that maybe, on the whole idea of a compact, obligating the state to the compact process. And it's very clear in this bill that any state can walk out of this process at any time up until there's three-fourths of the states that sign on, so that we are not obligated beyond that. Another kind of a fun thing is that amongst the people that have more or less endorsed this process, I named a few, but Georgia passed it both houses. So and then there's another one, Arizona, that is near where we are in the process of getting it passed. And we're the only three in the running. Well, the first three states set up the primaries of the commission. So if we can get this passed, we'll have, a fun couple of years anyway, until we see where it goes. But unless there's questions, I'll stop there in respect for your time. And keep in mind that I have a Nick online to answer questions, and he can backfill if you so choose.
I've got three people online: Nick Granius from the Goldwater Institute, Chip DeMoss in Houston, Texas, Compact for America, David Boyle in Anchorage. Senator Wilkowski, you had a question?
Yeah, I have a few questions, if I could, Mr. Chair. First one is on page 3, lines 13 through 17. This looks like the heart of it to me, anyway. It says we're adopting we're going to adopt a balanced budget amendment, which says that outstanding debt, and I'm reading from line 13, shall not exceed authorized debt, which initially shall be an amount equal to 105% of the outstanding debt. So I'd be curious, how much would we be having to cut? How much would the federal government be having to cut initially? And the first year it's passed, assuming it was this year, just so we can...
Super question.
Yeah. And then I guess my next question would be, what if there's national emergency, a war or something of that nature? Is there a stopgap or provision for that?
Yeah. Both of them are excellent questions. They've come up before. debt cap is 105% of the existing debt at the time this becomes a constitutional amendment. And 5% of, 20 trillion is about $100 billion or something. So there's quite a bit of room there for this to begin to give them time to give the government time to cut back on their spending, or if there's an increase in taxes, either one. The other thing to remember is when the total debt gets up to 98%, then there, it gives the president, the power to basically line item veto. Help me out. What's the word? The president can if Congress approves spending over 98%, he can pick and choose things not to spend money on in exchange for Congress responding. And the thing to remember is that, and it fits right in with your second question, is that the cap can be raised by a simple majority of the states. So if there was a national catastrophe or a war or whatever, you're talking turn around 26 states, if you think about it, you know, to respond and say, yeah, we can raise this cap. And the example that came up on the House floor is like 9/11. You know, if we have something facing us as a nation, it doesn't take long for the states to act and to endorse if we had to endorse a increase. Plus, there's a lot of I think it's 60 days, but in that 60 days, there's lots of slush money, funds, money in the military for them to work. So there's lots of, you know, actually the defense budget is a very small portion of the entire budget. So there's a lot of give and take that can happen in that arena. So it's just not a concern. And I guess the last thing is that if we have to borrow the money, the bonding process takes time. And I would argue that it doesn't take any more time to get 26 states to agree than it would to go through the debt process.
Representative, the actual hurdle is to get 26 states, you have to have a majority of the states.
Yes.
Senator Willis.
Still not real clear on how much the 105% would be. So if it were enacted today, let's say, how much would have to be cut from the state, from the federal government? Do you have a sense of that?
You know, and I might... there are three people online who actually may be able to get to that question. So I'm asking them to pay attention to the questions. Other questions, Senator Bulkowski?
Yeah, the other question was page 14, lines 20 through 21. It talks about each member state by and through its respective legislature hereby adopts and ratifies the balanced budget amendment. Does this apply to state government? And so, in other words, are we saying the state has to have a balanced budget amendment as well?
No, it's federal.
Through the chair.
Okay. And
yeah, I'm sorry. I'm a little sloppy, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Just thought I'd remind you.
Okay. Yeah, through the chair, this Senator Willikowski. No, this just means the legislature thereby adopts according to the terms of this HB 284 compact process. Okay.
And then I think last question, Mr. Chair, page 15, lines 14 through 18. Is there a reason we're selecting the United States District Court for the Northern District of Texas as the jurisdiction for disputes to be resolved?
Through the chair, Senator Willikowski, what I will defer to the helpers we've been getting from the Goldwater Institute, but I think that they had to pick a place, and they picked Texas. And Texas isn't even in the running on this at this moment. It's Arizona, Georgia, and Alaska. So I don't have an answer for you.
Actually, I have Chip DeMoss from Houston, Texas. Maybe he could shed some light because he's with Compact for America. Chip, are you online?
This is Chip talking. Nick would actually be a good one to answer that question.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll go to Nick then. He's in Phoenix, Arizona. Nick, did you hear the question?
I did, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the question. In fact, all the questions are excellent questions, and if there's a need to, I'd be happy to address each one. But in regards to this, it's a common feature of compacts to have a venue selection clause because of the risk that when you have numerous states in a compact, you could be hauled into court in a variety of different locations potentially. So the venue provision serves at minimum a purpose of minimizing where any member state could be hauled into litigation. And the other thing is we're anticipating at least 38 states joining this compact. So we wanted the venue to be a central location that is easily and conveniently accessible from virtually any state. Texas is pretty much really in the middle of the country. It's pretty easily accessible, no matter whether you're from Alaska or Hawaii or Georgia. And so it really just fit that parameter. Now, one thing to notice is that the commission of the compact, the three-member initially commission of the three first founding member states, can waive the venue provision if your chief law enforcement officer, your attorney general, requests that waiver. And so if it were inconvenient, I'm sure that, if we're successful in Alaska, Arizona, Georgia, the three founding member states, I'm sure that they would defer to the preference of the chief law enforcement officer as to where to bring or to defend litigation.
Since you're online, Nick, did you want to pursue that further, Senator Wilkowski?
No, but I was curious if he had a number on how much, if page 3...
Right. Let's go to the other two questions that came up, Nick, and I think on page 3 was the first one on the debt authorization.
I'm just trying to get a sense.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator. 105%. Right now we're at $17.55 trillion in debt. If this is ratified, if this compact is activated and successful in a one to three year time frame, the current burn rates will be in the neighborhood of $20 trillion in gross federal debt. And so 105% of that number would be an extra $1 trillion in borrowing capacity, a cushion, to allow for Congress to figure out what to do next. Now, there is no cut necessarily that's going to happen. We're borrowing currently at about $650 billion a year. That's the current burn rate on borrowing. So if you have a $1 trillion cushion, you've got a year to a year and a half under current borrowing rates, assuming we hold the line on that, for Congress to decide, is it going to enforce the cap and cut spending and close the deficit, or even perhaps consider raising taxes if it can do that, or will Congress do a combination of things? Will it restrain spending and then seek a proposal to be approved from the states to increase that debt limit? The key thing to emphasize here is we tried not to enforce a policy judgment on how the deficit would be handled. What we wanted to enforce was a guaranteed process of transparency where the issue is really forced to a head and nobody can evade it. And our belief is that if Congress knows that the writing's on the wall in a year to a year and a half, and if it knows that the president is going to have to start making impoundments as soon as they're within 2% of that limit, and if it knows that, therefore, it's going to automatically be subject to a 45% sequester if they don't figure it out, it's going to motivate Washington to figure out exactly how to fix the debt solution. I would anticipate it would be a mixture of a request to the states for additional borrowing capacity, perhaps a significant portion of spending cuts, and perhaps some possible revenue increases that would involve flattening the tax code. That's what I would anticipate would happen. But you can't really, guess as to the ultimate makeup of that. What we're doing here is we're trying to strike at the root cause of our debt problem, which is an unlimited concentration of borrowing authority in one hand. We're trying to strike at that root cause by bringing in the states as sort of an outside board of directors to make sure that Congress doesn't decide for itself, what amount of debt is appropriate for itself. That doesn't seem to work very well. And then the other thing we're trying to do is make sure that debate is carried out not just in Washington, but in 50 state capitals for a good year of total transparency in national debt policy. And we think that however things shake out, it will probably be a lot better than what we currently have, which is just kicking the can and suspending the debt limit whenever it seems inconvenient.
Senator Wilkowski has a further question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the ultimate goal of what you're trying to do at cutting the deficit. My constituents would be concerned about cuts to Medicare, Social Security, National Defense. I represent a military district and a lot of seniors in the area. And would you support amendments that I were to run to protect Medicare, Social Security, and National Defense from being cut?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would urge that we try to avoid implanting into this amendment policy choices as much as possible. I think the key thing here to have a chance of getting to 38 states to support something like this is to be as policy neutral and focused on what we know from polling data is likely to be successful. And from polling data, we've carefully polled every component of this balanced budget amendment. And pretty much everything is at a 61% to an 85% support level. Any effort to sort of shift this amendment to either center-left or hard center-right type policy can undermine the plausibility of the effort. So I would urge that we treat this amendment for what it is, which is a throttling back on debt and an incentive for spending cuts first before taxes are increased, but with flexibility on both ends. You can still, if necessary, get as much borrowing as states will approve, and therefore as much spending as the states will approve. All we're doing is making the states have a board of directors role. And you can still raise revenues, but the goal is not to kill the goose that lays the golden egg and raise revenues so much that you destroy the potential for the growth we need to both do the spending and pay back the debt. So those are really the core elements. And as I said, the goal is to keep the amendment as really policy neutral as possible, with the primary focus on limiting debt, bringing in outside intervention into Washington, and making sure that if we do have to raise revenues, we don't kill the golden goose.
Senator Wilkowski has further questions.
Yeah, I'd like to hear a little bit more about your polling data. Do you have polling data that shows that Americans support cuts to Medicare, Social Security, and national defense? Because I can tell you my constituents won't support that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we have extensive polling data that we'd be happy to share from McLaughlin and Associates, a nationally renowned polling resource. There's a number of drill-down questions in terms of what majorities of the American people want or are willing to tolerate to get our nation on a fiscal, sustainable fiscal track. I think you're correct that most Americans are not going to favor, you know, going right at Social Security first. But then again, there's nothing in this amendment that compels that. What this amendment does is say, look, the writing's on the wall. We can't continue what we've been doing, and we have to figure out what we have to do to get sustainable use of debt again. It may be the case that 26 states will approve an increase in the debt to allow for, you know, current levels of Social Security benefits, and that will become a non-issue under this amendment. The amendment does not, you know, compel a policy result where any particular program must be cut. It really is a function of what mix of borrowing, spending cuts, and tax revenue increases is going to put us on a track where we're once again sustainable. But I'd be happy to share that data. We have an executive summary and an extensive drill down. One of the interesting things is that Democrats, as much as Republicans, favor spending cuts before tax increases, and that was something really important when we were debating whether to include some sort of tax limit in the amendment. Our initial thoughts were not to include it, but it seems to be a fairly nonpartisan, close to center issue to favor, if push comes to shove, tax spending reductions over tax increases. But we have flexibility in this amendment to allow for revenue increases if indeed that that is deemed necessary.
Thank you. And I do have two other people online to testify, and probably what I should do at this point is go ahead and allow Chip DeMoss to give some brief testimony, and also David Boyle, who is with the Alaska Policy Forum. Mr. DeMoss, was there anything that you wanted to put online so that I don't have you waiting until right before we gavel out?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm the president of Compact for America. I live in Houston, Texas. I'm also a member of the board of directors. And I submitted to the chairman some written testimony from a number of the members of our advisory council for Compact for America, written testimony from Judge Harold DeMoss, senior judge on the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, also written testimony from Ilya Shapiro with the Cato Institute, who heads up the Constitutional Studies Group, written testimony from two PhD economists, that are in favor of the specifically of the Compact for America. A written testimony from Dr. Kevin Gutzman from Western Connecticut State University. He's a New York Times best-selling author of two books on constitutional history. Also a written testimony from one of our sponsors in Georgia, State Representative Andy Welch. And he also submitted additional appeals from 140 of his colleagues in the Georgia General Assembly. We did include in the written testimony the summary of the McLaughlin and Associates polling study, and I'll be happy to send the detailed report along to you, Mr. Chairman, as well. I know that was just requested, and we will get that to you right away. There is a section-by-section analysis of the compact, and also a one-pager on the built-in safeguards that were built into the compact, primarily based upon back and forth with Andy Shafley with Eagle Forum that occurred about 2 years ago over a period of about 6 months. So I'm here to answer any questions that any of the members may have regarding that testimony, and I thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, and there's a couple of blank pieces in my packet, so I will do some searching on that, and I'll make sure that that polling data gets to the members of the committee. Let me just go then to David Boyle from Alaska Policy Forum. David, are you there?
Yes, I am, Senator.
Senator, David, go ahead and give us your testimony at this point, please.
Chairman Cogfield, committee members, I'm David Boyle, and I'm representing the Alaska Policy Forum. I want to thank you for this opportunity to comment on House Bill 284. We are all aware that the federal debt is out of control and the current course is unsustainable. This debt threatens our future and, most of all, burdens our children and our grandchildren. Each child born in America today is born with a huge federal mortgage. We have a moral obligation to address this looming crisis that's going to destroy our way of life. By the way, this mortgage I spoke about is $58,600 for every person in this country. The U.S. ranks number 3 in debt per person, behind only Ireland and Japan. Americans are united. They want the government to reduce the national debt, as you've just heard. Sustained polling across decades and up to the present date shows that supermajorities of Americans want Washington to reduce the federal debt. Of course, nobody wants their box gored. These results are across party lines, age, race, and region of the country. Now, there is a common sense solution to the debt crisis. Let's require Congress to get approval from the states before it increases the federal debt by passing the compact for a balanced budget. Regular Americans like me and you have watched helplessly as Congress continues to mortgage our children's and our grandchildren's future. The people can require them to get the debt under control by supporting this compact for a balanced budget. Most Americans are outraged that both parties in Washington are mortgaging our kids' future, but we have to face up to the fact that Washington is the problem. It won't fix itself. With this national debt poised to be over $17 trillion today, and the political establishment in Washington wants still more boring authority. Our only hope lies outside of the Beltway with the compact for a balanced budget. And it's time to change this political game in Washington. We have to impose a limit on the federal government's credit card. The people in Washington will not do this themselves. The compact for a balanced budget would do just that. We cannot trust the political class in Washington with unlimited debt. What does our ever-increasing U.S. debt do to Alaska and other states? And this is most important. As this U.S. debt grows, the federal government will look at increasing taxes and extracting other wealth from the individual states, leaving states such as Alaska with less wealth to fund our needs at a proper level. The power of the states will diminish, and the power of the federal government will consequently increase. In addition, the reach of the federal government into every Alaskan's life will also multiply. This is difficult to imagine if today's overbearing federal agencies, such as the EPA, the Department of Education, and the Interior Department, as we see every day in Alaska. We all care about the national debt in the future we are leaving to our children. The Compact for a Balanced Budget brings Republicans, Democrats, Independents, and yes, everyone together to help solve our debt crisis that Washington is unable to do. This brings all of us Americans together in deciding upon the proper role and use of debt. The Compact for a Balanced Budget is designed to achieve this goal in as little as 12 months, much quicker than the usual convention of the states. With Congress's recent decision to suspend limits on borrowing, we don't have the luxury of time before the country follows behind Greece in a huge debt default debacle. This is a clear and present danger today, right now. The states must institute the necessary fiscal controls over Congress without delay. We have to put the pressure on the folks in Washington. Your support of House Bill 284, the Compact for a Balanced Budget, is requested. And please pass it out of committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Mr. Boyle, thank you very much for taking the time to be in front of the committee. At this point, my intention is just to hold the bill over. We'll come back with some of the more detailed questions probably on Wednesday, be a good time to bring up any more specific questions on this bill. I think right now at this point we've got a pretty good idea of some of the issues on it. I know you have a committee waiting for you anxiously, and I want to make sure, is there any last questions at this point that we need to be thinking about before I bring it back on Wednesday? All right. With that, we're going to lay the bill aside till Wednesday. And on Wednesday, we also are going to bring up House Bill 366, which is involuntary commitment, and House Bill 369, which is immunity for drug-related offense, issues that we'll probably want some thorough vetting as well. With that, we're going to lay the bill aside, and we will adjourn this meeting until Wednesday.